Awesome. Here we are back to it on the Monday evening with Winfrey and Terry Brown located in Sedona, Arizona. We have a one-hour episode, the wild card for the Monday evening. My name is Gijs Minderhout, located in California. 1 hour, and this is as usual a simulcast with a conference call. Today it is June the 15th, 2020. Several things. Welcome, you guys. If you want to, please say your name and location.
Cecil from Seattle.
Welcome, Cecil.
Hi, Cecil.
Hey, Cecil.
Hi, Cecil.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Dr. Art.
Welcome,
hey,
Dr. Art.
Yeah, we're here.
Good to have you.
Thank you.
Who else? Feel free to say a name and location.
Hi, hi, it's everybody. I'm Shirley from Ohio.
I hear Shirley. Hi, Shirley. Welcome.
Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Shirley.
And I think I heard another voice. Please speak up.
Mary Eileen, hello.
Hello,
hi,
Mary Eileen. Welcome.
Hi, Mary Eileen.
Hi, Mary Eileen.
Hi, Mary Eileen.
Win in Sedona.
Win in Sedona.
Oh,
welcome, Win.
Hey, Win.
Are you a new caller?
What?
Yes, if you are new to the call.
Someone else joined in. Welcome. Please say a name and location. Or maybe the next caller. Welcome. Please say a name and location.
Hi, Hiyas. It's Prudy.
Welcome,
Prudy.
Prudy.
Hi, thank you.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Debbie in Costa
Mesa. Hi, good evening, Debbie. Welcome.
Hi, you guys. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi, hello, Antonio.
Terry, thank you so much.
Yeah. What Hiyas is referring to is there was a couple at 99A in California in a crusher, Neil, and they were killed in an accident yesterday, and I was checking in on them. Last Wednesday. And they were trying to get oriented. They just kept thinking, I got to get home. They were sticking around. They didn't realize the situation. But I was checking in on him and reported to Hiyas because he knows the man, and he was going to go and see if he could help in some way. But they're starting to realize what happened to them.
So do they not have the view of the scenery? They don't see daylight, so to speak?
No, they see daylight, but they were unwilling to accept what they were seeing. It's like it's just they were stuck in the scene before the accident, you know.
Are they kind of like outside of time also, as it has been taken days?
Yeah, I mean, they're trying very hard to not move with time. They're moving with time, but they're trying to just go back to just before the accident. They kind of keep replaying it in their mind, like, you know, it's like if we did something different, then we'll wake up from the nightmare.
You know, it was essentially they were in their car, and they didn't know anything was happening, and then suddenly they were killed instantly. They probably don't even know why they died.
Right.
They were suddenly rear-ended by a semi truck going full speed into the back of their car, and it pushed their car into there were six cars involved. But I think that there's something wrong with the scene. It's like maybe they should have a signal light a little further on up the road, because people go fast on 99, from my experience.
It's a 65 mile an hour route, yes.
Yeah, And so if you've got six cars backed up, it's not even like you've got the same space to stop as if there was only one car or no cars. And maybe he was so far from the light he wasn't paying attention, or, you know, who knows.
Wasn't that on the news where they closed down 99?
Yeah. It was closed for 12 hours, yes.
Yeah.
Both directions, yeah.
Did the truck driver survive?
Yes. I don't know. Did he?
Yeah,
okay.
The truck driver survived, and all the people in the other car survived.
Were they at the back of the whole thing, or?
They were the sixth car. Right. The two who got killed were the last car in line, and then the semi drove onto them. And I think five other ones were hospitalized from the other cars in front of them.
Yeah.
But it is so, you know, I'm trying to imagine how it is as a soul, you know, that they're hanging out there at that location. It's kind of hard to understand for me that they, particularly when the bodies are being, you know, taken away and moved to a different location, how they are not realizing.
They must have been really bad. They burned because the car was mangled.
Yeah.
And it caught on fire.
So, and do they reunite with the body until the burial? Or
no. I mean, they got kicked out of the body.
Do you think in this circumstance they will not be present at their funeral?
It depends. They take some time and come around. I mean, a person can come around really fast when they realize, like Loopy, the lady, like she might cross over really fast, but she wants to bring David with her, and so she's hanging around waiting for David, and David is he's. You knew him. He was a very responsible person from what I pick up.
Yes, yes. And so were they in touch with each other after the accident?
Well, he was just stunned, and she was trying to say, come on, David, we got to get out of here. she was a little bit ahead. She was ahead of David. And, I picked up he was so responsible. It's like he took his responsibilities, his family, his payment on his place where he lived, and I think Loopy lived with him, and maybe she had a son or something there too.
Welcome to the next caller. Thank you for being here. Please say a name and location.
Hi, this is Jeannie in Citrus Heights.
Good evening, Jeannie. Welcome.
Hi, Jeannie.
And I also welcome all those that are listening in online through BBS Radio. Good evening to you, and welcome to this Monday night episode, The Wild Card with Winfrey and Terry Brown.
Go ahead.
I think I'm going to start the recording and get started, okay?
Okay.
I got the links.
All right.
Whoops. You want me to get the recording going, Ben?
Yes.
Are you ready,
Ben? The recording has started.
You're too slow. This is June 15th, 2020. And it's interesting. We were just talking before the call. And Heise has two...
Muted.
two friends that passed, and they were killed instantly on Route 99 when a big truck, a semi, hit them from behind, and their car, and they hit six other cars, but they were the ones that died, and they died instantly. So Heise asked Terry to check in on them, and it started out that at first they didn't understand what happened. In other words, they didn't know the truck was going to hit them, and it happened all in an instant, and they were still hanging out in the area of where they were killed, even though their bodies were taken away. But their bodies apparently were fairly burned, so there wasn't much to identify with, probably, because a lot of times people will stay with their bodies. And the woman, Lucy, was that her name?
Lupe
was becoming aware that something had happened. And she was preparing to leave the scene. And
she kept saying to David, you know, come on, we got to get out of here. Come on, we got to go home. Come on. Come on, you know, we just got to get out of here. But he was like, you know, no, I'm going to wake up from the nightmare in a minute, and then we're going to resume our trip home with the car.
And so, actually, before the call, I decided I was going to do a replay. I hope so. I hope it'll play. And I forgot about this. And I picked the replay of what happens when you die. And this was one of those epic calls from 2011, where Terry's really best friend, John, who had lived with her for 30 years and was living in Sedona at a little cabin that we had rented for him for a while. We were living together in Terry's house. But John
and my friend.
Yeah, John has this historic background with Terry because they were married in a past life in Greece. And at this point, I'm pretty sure this is true. And, you know, when I met Terry, John was living in her living room on the couch. And she had taken him in from being homeless. And he never worked. All he did
was... Well, he did work, but he lost his job.
He lost his job.
But the company went bankrupt that he was working for.
Okay, but then he didn't work after that.
He went to live in his van.
He just on the street,
and he had no gas.
And when Terry took him in, he was writing. He was a writer, and he was translating Greek plays, and he was writing all kinds of stuff. Now, I'm curious about going back and looking at his writings, because Terry now has five boxes of his writings that his daughter sent Terry. And because at a certain point, there were indications that John was the reincarnation of Socrates. And Terry was his wife. Let me see.
Xantippe.
And they have a historical reputation because Socrates would go out and hang out in the cafes and talk to the young people in the town and philosophize to them. And Xantippe was somehow managing to keep everything afloat because Socrates never made any money. And he wouldn't have become famous except he had this one very educated, elite kind of student by the name of Plato. And when they poisoned Socrates for corrupting the youth, and after he died, Plato wrote up his teachings. And interestingly enough, Terry and I had become friends with this guy who was a writer, and he also had a fairly successful business. He was very, very smart and very elite. You know, I don't know if you guys understand what I mean by elite. Elite doesn't have to be negative.
He had money, and Plato had money.
And the way we met him is because he became a devotee of Carla Ruckert's Law of One material. And he decided he was going to write a book that would be like a novel where this talking dog would espouse the Law of One. And it was called Going Deeper. And it didn't become a big hit, a big success. But it was very interesting because we didn't have any idea that he was Plato at that time. But he lived in Palm Springs. And Terry and I would be driving from L.A. to Sedona back and forth fairly often because she was keeping a dual residence in both L.A. She had her job and in Sedona. And we would always stop in Palm Springs and go out and have coffee with Jean-Claude. And one time we were talking about John, who was living in Terry's house. And Jean-Claude suddenly came to attention saying, "I want to meet that guy," which was fairly unusual for him because he was somewhat aloof. You know, he didn't socialize and meet new people. He kept to himself and his own projects. And we were driving back continuing from his house, and I was saying, you know, that was really unusual that he wanted to meet John. And I looked up the picture of Plato, and I found out that Plato had an extremely strong resemblance to Jean-Claude, and John had an extremely strong resemblance to Socrates.
Yeah, and I told John, when we got back to Sedona, I told John, Jean-Claude would like to meet you. And he got a little nervous, and he said, "What are we going to talk about?" I said, "Just be yourself.
I wish I paid John more attention in a more friendly way, because I used to think that he was taking advantage of Terry, living in her living room, and he was a freeloader, and he didn't like me too much, because although he wasn't having a relationship with Terry, he still had a certain possessiveness about her. And I ended up feeling very fond of him. But in any case, he died in 2011. And he was living in this little cottage. And there was a laundry room. And somehow he crashed his car into the laundry room. Ended up in the hospital. And Terry was there when he died. And she helped him. She helped him move into the tunnel of light. And it's a an interesting story. And this is a show we did on it back then. And let me see, what time is it?
We have 21 minutes left airtime.
How many more minutes?
31.
Okay, better start.
Yeah. I'm moving it forward. Because this is 55 minutes, 45 minutes, 13, 55, 45, 42. So we'll start 15 minutes in. And here we go.
Now, part of the main body of work of Robert Frost. And John loved jazz, and he knew a lot of the top jazz performers, including Steve Hofstadter, who has a 19-piece for soul band, and he plays for clubs and restaurants around Pasadena area. And he has records out, Steve Hofstadter, jazz musician extraordinaire. And so where John lived, sometimes somebody would be playing music and all the, like rock or something, and all that would come through to John's little trailer was woom, 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 woom. And he, you know, you couldn't hear the highs or anything. And John said he'd rather die than listen to that music. And it didn't go on all the time. He lived in a really beautiful little place by the creek, Oak Creek. And he was very loving person, and he had a full range of emotional tones. So he could get angry, or he could get lovable, or he could get joyous, or he could get sad and griefy. And he had a history of where he was in the Navy. On PT boat 77, and about a week and a half ago, he told me about the story about how when he was on the PT boat, the the PT boat was bombed. It was actually friendly fire, and he was badly injured with a lot of bomb fragments in his neck and in his leg. And somebody said, "Don't mind him, he's dead." And then somebody else came around later, and John said he was still alive. He said to them, "I'm not going to open my eyes unless you promise to take us back to land." So
they used to, they took him back to land, they took the boat back, and they put him in the hospital there on the shore. And the kamikaze planes called the PT boats the devil boats. And they would send the kamikaze planes on suicide missions to attack the boat, to dive bomb into them, to destroy them. And when they would do that, Sandy Tredinnick was the skipper, and John might be in the wheelhouse. And Sandy and John had a strategy for avoiding the collision with the kamikaze plane, the Zero plane, and it would be aimed straight at their boat. And when they would turn the boat toward the plane and sit there idle in the water until the plane was totally committed and couldn't change its course, and then they'd flip the wheel around and the plane would go into the water next to the boat. And this was a very good way of avoiding getting hit by a kamikaze plane. Well, after John got bombed by friendly fire, he said friendly fire was hard because you couldn't shoot back because it was our plane. And they had gone out in the water during this big battle. And the planes, it was a cross communication. The planes had the order to shoot everything out of the water that was out there. And one plane came over, and on the radio, the plane said, "Is that a little martini boat down there?" And the boat radio operator said, "Yes." And she said, "Get out of there. We've got orders to shoot everything out of the water down there." And then the second plane came along and bombed them. Well, so they took the boat back, repaired it, and put John in the hospital. And they sent the boat back out. And the PT boat, PT-77, were out to sea. And a kamikaze plane came a little too close. And all the whole crew realized that they were going to get hit. And so they all jumped overboard. And they were all saved. Well, John heard the announcement from the hospital that the PT boat 77 was hit. And so he thought all of his friends were dead. And so he was going away to get some food at the canteen. And he came back to the hospital. When he walked in the hospital, he said all 15 of the guys from the PT-77 boat were in the hospital there, and they were all beaming at him because he thought they were all dead, and they were all beaming because they had something over on them because they'd all survived. And so he when he told me that a couple weeks ago, he was just crying because he was so happy to see all those guys that they had survived. He heard a lot of good stories about his times. He had a lot of good friends and a lot of good memories. He was responsible for a lot of books that were published and edited in Scientology. He had put together the 08 book, and he put together the Auditor series, the Red on White. He put together the Admin series, the Administration series, and he had added lots of the books and gotten a whole crew together to help edit and to publish books. He went to England and Scotland and worked with the organization in publishing books. He was a really extraordinarily good writer. And when I edited,
he actually read The Reincarnation of Edgar Casey when we were doing it, and added his own thoughts about it. I think we took some of his thoughts and made some changes, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. Like, there would be whole paragraphs, like, at the beginning or other parts of the book where they didn't seem to hang together right, and I'd take them to John, and I'd read them to him, and John would either make suggestions on how to make them better, or he'd say, trash the whole thing and start over. Because there's nothing to work with.
I would say that when we were writing that book, you know, John is an extraordinary writer, and I guess part of what he wanted was to be successful as a writer himself, and he never became that, except perhaps for the stuff he did with Ron Hubbard. And I'm not a Ron Hubbard supporter, but John actually put his heart into that and was there at the very beginning of that organization and probably made quite a difference in the way it grew. And John was a genius in his own way. And in recent times, he was living in Sedona, and he was living here because Terry moved him here, and he's 88 years old. And basically living kind of as a recluse, and every day his main thing was to go to the health food store. He became friends with all the employees, like this knurly guy who would walk through the store, and everyone knew him. He cut a very striking, energetic image, and he worked really, how would I say it? He created a lot of affinity with the people there. Now, Terry had the idea that John might have been Socrates in one of his lifetimes, because a lot of his philosophy, things that he would say, were very similar to Socrates. And Socrates had a similar aspect to him where he was very much a loner, and he would go, if he's ever read the history of Greece and Athens, he would go into the public places and schmooze with the people in public places. And he would kind of get a following. He would sit down, I guess, at the cafes or wherever people could sit down. And young people would sit down around him. And he would kind of just engage them in such a way as to force himself to make wise observations in their lives. And he never wrote anything, except Plato was one of the young people, and Plato then wrote about Socrates after Socrates died. And of course, Socrates died because he was corrupting the youth, and he was... He was accused of corrupting the youth, and the state poisoned him. And he went, his students wanted to save him, but he wouldn't allow himself to be saved. He said, well, I'm going to follow the law. If they want me to die, then fine. And for a period, I thought Terry was just off the deep end. But then when I started, you know, I'm going to move this forward a little bit because I told that story before we started. And let's get to the point. There we go. Hang on. Driving out. We don't know why. Either he went unconscious, or something went wrong with the car, or he stepped on the gas instead of the brake, and he hit the building, and the seatbelt broke three of his ribs. And the next thing we know, he's in the hospital in Flagstaff, which is 30 miles from here. And Terry went there and started doing a vigil with him. And what Terry experienced is the reason I decided to make this. The topic of this call. There we go. I got some tears. And Terry, you want to share that? It's I'm just gauging the time. It's 7:32. By the way, somebody emailed me, and they said, last week I cut Terry off because we were going to do a channeling, and we only had a few minutes left. And so if anyone thinks that I cut her off because I was being rude, I'm sorry that I gave that idea. But I know people look forward to hearing messages from the sky people on these calls. And so that's why I did it. I apologize to Terry and anyone who thought that that was impolite. In any case, I'm not going to cut you off, Terry. Although, if you feel like we can do a channeling about this, and if not, you know, we have about 7:33, we have about 20 minutes left. Why don't you tell people what happened and what you experienced in the hospital in Flagstaff?
Yeah. I went up there. The police wouldn't talk to anybody except Jane, who is John's daughter. And so they called Jane, and Jane said she was going to fly in. But I went up there, and I got there. I wanted to go that night. However, and I was getting stuff ready to go. However, by that time, it was probably 11:45 at night. The accident happened about 4, and I found out about it about 6. And so I was still getting ready to go up there, and but it seemed so dark and so late at night that it seemed like I shouldn't be driving that far, and it might be unsafe to drive up there alone on the lonely road. So I waited until next day, and I got up there, and John was still on the breathing tube, and they said he was he had stabilized. He came in critical, but then he had stabilized. So they had him in intensive care, and they had him all hooked up to all of these monitors that monitored his heart, his heart rate, his blood pressure. There was about 12 things that they were monitoring. And so I talked to the nurse and said that they were going to try and take out the breathing tube and have him breathe on his own. So he couldn't really talk, but he was very alert. And I had brought some papers with me for his insurance policy that he had to sign. So I talked to him, and he first of all he wanted a piece of paper. He couldn't talk because of breathing tube and stuff. So he made a motion of writing, like he wanted me to give him a pen and a surface to write on it and some paper. So I got him that. And he wrote, "Tell me," like, "Tell me what happened." So he wrote, "Tell me," on the paper. And so I told him what I knew of what had happened. And then the bunch of nurses came in, and they were going to take out the breathing tube. And they were joking with him. After they took out the breathing tube, he started to be able to talk. And like they said, okay, we're gonna like he had knocked out his lower teeth and his jaw, like his lower lip had been cut, like as he hit the steering wheel. He in the accident, he'd hit the building, and actually the bumper had gone through a 6-inch cement walk wall, and his face hit the steering wheel, and the safety belt broke his ribs. So he was having a hard time breathing because his ribs were in the wrong place. They were dislocated. And so they had wired his jaw, wired his teeth back in, and wired his jaw. And But so he was starting to be able to talk, and I had had him sign the papers before they took out the breathing tube, and he was like guiding me to guide his hand to know where to start writing, and he wrote his name on through the papers, and then I went during the rest time when the place was closed to visitors. I went and I faxed him to the insurance company, and then I went back. But in the afternoon before the rest time, the three nurses came in and they said, "All right, we want to clean up your chin." And he says, "Why?" And they said, "Because you're ugly. And we want to clean the blood off your chin." He says, "I don't care if I'm ugly." And then they were moving him around in the bed. And he said, "Why are you doing that?" And they said, "Because we want to get some blood circulating through your butt." And he says, "Oh, you like bloody butts." And, you know, he was just this humor. They turned to me and said, is this normal behavior for him? And I said, yes. And so they were talking, and he was using very big words with them, which he always does. I mean, he had a huge vocabulary and a genius IQ. And so one nurse said, "Wow, he has a really big vocabulary." And by this time, his daughter Jane had arrived, and Jane said, "Yes, he's one of the smartest men I ever met." And so he was joking around, since he was doing that joking with the nurses and stuff, I thought, "Wow, you know, this is a really good sign." And everybody was figuring he was stabilizing and he was going to make it through this and heal. So I told him, I said, "Your job is to heal." And it's like he was taking instructions. He was following the instructions and nodding that he understood them and stuff. And he did say, you know, he said, "Don't you guys have any pain medication?" And they said, "You're on pain medication." And he said, "Doesn't your pain medication work?" And so they upped his pain medication until they reached a point where he wasn't in pain anymore. But that made him groggy. And he kind of slept a lot. So the next day, he was alert in the morning, and Jane was with him all morning. And in the afternoon, he became unresponsive. And so then all the monitors and everything showed that he wasn't expelling the air. And his CO2 rate, his body was not getting enough oxygen because it wasn't expelling the CO2. And he couldn't breathe deep enough to get the air out too, because of the broken ribs. They were just moved right into the middle of his chest. And the hospital gave us, like, when I went back, Jane told me that the hospital had indicated it was bad news, that he wasn't going to make it. And they gave him 24 to 48 hours, that his body was shutting down. His liver was shutting down. His kidneys were shutting down. And his heart was beating irregularly, which had been a problem, too, before the accident. He had noticed that and asked me about it, had me feel his pulse. So they took him off the breathing stuff. They had him on oxygen. They took him off the oxygen mask, put in a breathing tube, but they asked him at one point if he wanted to be resuscitated, which would involve surgery and draining the liquids from his lungs because his lungs were filling with liquids. And he thought about it a long time, and then he said no, he didn't want to be resuscitated. So then they moved him to a beautiful room overlooking twin peaks, snow-covered teach in Flagstaff. And so he had a bed there, and I stayed all night that night in the hospital, and they were really sweet. It's like they brought me breakfast in the morning, and Jane came back in the morning, and they brought us a couple of big Starbucks coffees. And Jane was joking at first with her dad, you know, seeing, they're giving, what are these tubes? They're giving you milkshake and coffee through these tubes. And she was joking with him. Okay, Dad, let me wheel you down the quarters. And we can say hello to people, and we can take all this equipment with us, all these monitors and all these wires, although it might be quite difficult. And John said he didn't want to do that. And Jane said she did. She thought it would be fun. So she was joking with him. She has a good sense of humor, too. So when we got over to the other room, they took him off the monitors, and they would just come in every 4 hours or so and just take his blood pressure and check him out and turn him so he didn't get bed sores and stuff. And so they gave him 48 hours. And so at one point, I lowered his pain medication with him so that he would be able to be responsive and talk because he didn't think he'd be responsive on that heavy dose of pain medication. So they lowered it, but then he became uncomfortable and in pain again, so Jane had him raise it again. I had him raise it some, and then Jane had him raise it more, I think. So then Jane and I were talking about what can be done or how we would handle it when he died. And at first he had kicked us out of the room when we were talking, but later on we were talking in the room and he was pretty unconscious. But I sensed that he was hearing everything. And I told Jane, I thought that he was hearing everything we were saying. And sometimes one of the workers pointed out that when people die, they leave, like when the family goes to get a bite to eat, or they leave the room for a minute, then the person takes that minute to slip out and leave. So Jane and I were talking, and I noticed that John had stopped breathing. And so I pointed that out to Jane. And Jane had been, just before he stopped breathing for about 3 days, every time Jane was with him, she was holding his hand, and she was telling him she loved him, and he was saying he loved her. And like at one point, the first day she got there, he was like, Jane, Jane. And he was so happy to see her. And so I was holding his other hand. And I was telling him also that I loved him. And he told me, like, that he never said before, he said he loved me. And so he was feeling a very loving surroundings. He wasn't in pain. And the nurses were being very friendly to him. So it was a very loving environment. And he just opened up with responding with love. And so then when he left his body, I had noticed just probably an hour or so before, that there was this huge angel that had come and was just checking things out. And it was huge because John's a big man. He's 6'1". And this is a huge angel with huge wings. And it's like bigger than John. And so he was just checking things out. And so after he stopped breathing, Jane said, "Do you see the angels?" And I looked, and the huge angel was there. So I spotted John, and he was out of his body. And I said, "Let the angel guide you to the portal. for the tunnel of light. And so and at one point I said, don't give the angels any trouble. Anyway, I was right with him. And so he was in front of me. The angel was first guiding John to the tunnel of light. And then I was behind John, making sure he found it. And so we went, so we found the tunnel, the portal to the other side. We found it. And John went, followed the angel in, and I followed John in to the tunnel of light. And I wanted to make sure that he made it. And so he was up ahead of me, and I was observing the tunnel. It was like lights, and the lights were sending energies of different frequencies through me, that a kind of a clearing energy, a kind of a changing my energy and translating that energy to a higher frequency. And John was in front of me, and he said, I said to him, go find Robert Frost. And Jane said, go find the Poetry Corner. And I said, and go find your jazz friends. Go find Billie Holiday. And I said, go find your friends from P.T. Boat 77. And he started to get really excited about seeing them because he dearly loved these people. And so he looked back and he said, would I be okay? That he didn't want to leave me here because he wanted to make sure I was okay. And he was worried that I might not be okay. And so I said, I'm going to be okay. And he said, he was still doubtful about it. And he was kind of hesitating in the tunnel of light. And I said, I'm going to be okay. And he kind of had doubts about it, but I assured him several times, and I kept indicating, go find your jazz friends. And he was getting really excited about seeing his friends. And finally, he asked me one time more, are you going to be okay? And I said, yes. And so he just went forward. And at that point, I had to get out of the tunnel of light because I was starting to get disoriented. And so I went back out of the tunnel, and he went forward. And then Jane and I looked, and the connection between John and I and Jane was getting thinner and thinner as he moved on the tunnel of light. And so then he was gone, and I went in, and we told the nurse, and the nurse came in, and so we could stay as long as we wanted. And then the coroner came in, and they put the body in a body bag and got it ready to take away. But there was no life left, and his body was turning pale. And so we didn't for a couple of days, it's like Jane and I couldn't feel him, like the thread was gone. And then yesterday, Wynn and I were listening to songs where these songs were choosing a song to send out to one of the spirit channels, or to send out to people on the mailing list. And there was a song from West Side Story, which I really love it. It's like somewhere there's a place for us. But then there was another song, We Shall Be Released, and we played it. And it started to seem really, really slow, and I could hardly stand listening to it because it was so slow, and I noticed a light around me, and a very high frequency. And Wynn said, "John's beaming down on you." And then I looked, and it's like John had been, like he was up there in a viewing window open from the higher heavenly realm down to here. And there was John, and there was a couple of his friends in the room.
Jerry, Seth is going to cut us off any moment.
Okay,
we got to stop. Our time is running out on BBS. And are you there, Terry? Am I there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here.
You're there. Okay.
Yeah.
That brings tears to my eyes every time I do it.
To me, too.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you all. I'm going to unmute you. We're going over to...
Unmuted.
Thank you, Seattle.
712-770-4340 in 250-513.